Welcome to Lessons in Tanya, Chapter 27. In our previous deep dive, we spent a good deal of time exploring how sadness, you know, in its various forms, can really get in the way of genuine spiritual service. We particularly zeroed in on that kind of heavy feeling that comes from, well, mundane worries, material things, or even the weight of past mistakes. We talked about how those feelings can be serious roadblocks in that inner battle we all face with the inclination for evil. But today, we're shifting gears a bit. We're looking at a different kind of melancholy. This one isn't about anxiety over things you've done, but more about those unwelcome, troubling thoughts and desires that just pop into your mind. You know, the ones when your mind wanders somewhere you didn't intend, or presence urges you know aren't helpful. Now, this kind of sadness, sparked by these intrusive thoughts, it can happen in two main situations. First, when you're just going about your day, doing normal stuff, work, chores, life. And second, when these same thoughts barge in and disturb your spiritual focus, maybe during study or prayer. For this deep dive, though, we're going to really focus on that first situation.
When these challenging thoughts show up while you're busy with everyday mundane activities. And here's the really surprising part, the core insight of this chapter. These thoughts, the ones we usually dread, they shouldn't cause sadness. Actually, incredibly, they should give rise to joy. It's a pretty radical reframe of our inner experience.
Oh, it absolutely is. Radical is the right word. It completely flips our usual understanding, doesn't it? How we react to internal struggles, our emotional responses. I mean, most of us, when those unwelcome thoughts come up, we feel, what? Failure? Guilt? Maybe just tired resignation. You think, oh, not again. Or why can't I control my mind?
Yeah.
But this teaching suggests something totally different. A deeply positive, even joyful side to these experiences. It really invites you to rethink everything about inner turmoil, turning it from disappointment into, well, an unexpected source of strength.
Okay, let's definitely unpack that surprising truth then. How can these troubling thoughts possibly lead to joy? Because like you said, when unwanted thoughts or desires pop up, maybe something forbidden, a critical thought, or just some annoying, trivial thing, our immediate gut instinct is usually to feel bad, right? That little pang of distress, maybe even sadness. It feels like a failure, doesn't it?
That's absolutely the common reaction. It feels natural, especially if you're trying to grow spiritually. But the Alter Rebbe offers a profoundly different lens here. He teaches that if the sadness isn't from guilt over past actions, which is a separate thing we covered, needing introspection, maybe remorse, but if it's purely from the fact that these kinds of thoughts are entering your mind, especially during mundane activities, then quite surprisingly, you should actually be happy in his lot.
Mm.
It's almost counterintuitive telling you to be happy about something that feels negative.
Happy in your lot. Because the thoughts are just there.
Yeah.
Not because you acted on them.
Exactly. The mere presence, if they're uninvited, isn't a failure. It's potentially, well, a setup for something positive. But, and this is really crucial, we need to be super clear, this only applies if you do not willfully dwell on these thoughts. If you actively engage them, invite them in, mull them over, fantasize, that's different.
Right. That's a sin of thought itself. We talked about that.
Precisely. That warrants the introspection, the sadness maybe. But here, the focus is squarely on those involuntary, intrusive thoughts, the ones that just appear, unbidden. You wish they hadn't popped up, and your immediate reaction is to push them away.
Okay, so the key action then is averting one's attention from them. What does that really look like in practice? Is it like trying to forcefully suppress them, shove them down? Because that often backfires, doesn't it?
It does. Suppression often makes things stronger.
Or is it something more like redirection, a different kind of mental move?
It's definitely more active than passive ignoring. It's a redirection, like you said, a kind of spiritual muscle flex. And it ties directly into a core spiritual instruction from ancient texts. You shall not follow after your heart and after your eyes, by which you go astray. So by actively averting your mind, consciously choosing not to engage with that intrusive thought, you are right then and there fulfilling this command. You're choosing not to be led astray internally.
Okay, so it's an active compliance with that directive.
Yes, a deliberate mental shift. You're asserting control at that moment of choice.
Yeah, makes sense. It's like proactive spiritual defense. But it does raise a question for me. What about someone who doesn't get these thoughts?
Yeah.
Like a perfectly righteous person, someone whose mind is, you know, pure. How could they fulfill this specific command? It seems like the command itself assumes the thoughts are there to be resisted.
Exactly. You've nailed a key distinction. It's fundamental here. This command is absolutely not for the perfectly righteous. For someone who, through immense spiritual work, has truly eradicated that inner source of negativity. Well, these thoughts just don't arise for them. Their minds are aligned with holiness.
So telling them don't follow something that isn't there would be pointless.
Right. It would be absurd. So this verse is specifically for those who do experience these thoughts. It's commanding them to actively banish them, to avert their attention. This is the realm of what the Alter Rebbe calls the intermediate person, the Benoni. And that's the realistic station for most of us.
Okay. So the struggle itself is part of the path for the intermediate person?
Think of it like building muscle. You need resistance, right? Lifting air doesn't make you stronger.
You need the weight on the bar.
Exactly. Similarly, that spiritual muscle of averting attention, of choosing not to follow the thought, it only gets engaged, only gets stronger when there's an intrusive thought to avert. Without that resistance, there's no spiritual workout, no chance to actively choose the higher path in that moment. So the thought's presence, paradoxically, becomes the very opportunity for growth and for fulfilling that command.
Wow. Okay. So the opportunity is embedded in the challenge itself.
Precisely. And this leads to something truly remarkable taught by the ancient sages. They say that when one passively refrains from sin, he is rewarded as though he had actively performed a positive divine commandment.
Passively refrains, meaning just not doing the wrong thing, or in this case, not dwelling on the wrong thought.
Exactly. Just the act of not following through, not engaging.
And that gets rewarded as if you did something actively positive, like fulfilling a whole commandment.
Yes. It's not just avoiding a negative. It's gaining a positive spiritual credit. It transforms that moment.
That is huge. Because normally you think avoiding sin is just baseline, not an active accomplishment.
Right. But this teaching elevates it completely. And that's the source of the joy this chapter talks about, because the thought intruding gives you the chance to fulfill that command, don't follow after your heart and eyes, by actively averting. And by doing that, you earn the significant reward. So the thought itself, strangely enough, becomes the trigger for joy. Not joy in the thought, obviously.
No, of course not. Joy in the response.
Yes. Joy in the victory over it, the spiritual exercise completed, the reward earned. It's not a sign you failed. It's a setup for spiritual achievement right there in the middle of your ordinary life.
So it challenges that whole idea that any negative thought is a spiritual setback, something to feel bad about.
Absolutely. It positions it as a potential springboard.
It turns the struggle into an opportunity for connection, for growth, even when you're just, I don't know, washing the dishes.
Exactly. It's a quiet inner satisfaction, a recognition, okay, I just did something spiritually significant there.
That is a really profound reframing. It changes the whole emotional weight of those moments.
All right.
But, okay, if these thoughts aren't inherently a reason for sadness, if they're actually these opportunities, why do we still feel that distress? Why is the gut reaction often disappointment or feeling like we've failed spiritually? There must be something else driving that sadness if this teaching is true.
You're right, there often is. And the Alter Rebbe identifies it. He says that kind of sadness is often rooted in, well, in conceit.
Conceit, that sounds harsh. How can feeling bad about a bad thought be conceited? It feels like the opposite, like humility, recognizing you're not perfect.
It's a subtle point, definitely. It's not conceit like arrogance, look how great I am.
Yeah.
It's conceit in the sense of not knowing or perhaps not accepting your true spiritual place, your station. You feel distressed because you haven't reached the level of the perfectly righteous, the ones who don't get these foolish thoughts, as the text calls them.
Ah, so it's like being upset you're not something you're not meant to be right now or haven't achieved yet.
Precisely. It's a misaligned expectation. You're holding yourself to a standard that isn't currently yours, or maybe isn't even your ultimate designated path.
But can you give an analogy, maybe?
Sure. Imagine, like a beginner painter, first lesson. They make a few brushstrokes. Then they look at their canvas and compare it instantly to, say, a Rembrandt or a Monet.
Okay.
And they get utterly dejected. This is terrible. I'm useless. I'll never be like them. They throw down the brush in despair. Is that humility? Or is it a kind of conceit? They're not appreciating the process, the learning, their current stage. They're demanding mastery instantly.
Right. They're not accepting where they are in the journey.
Exactly. So the intermediate person who gets distressed by thoughts that don't bother the perfectly righteous, they're kind of doing the same thing. They're not fully accepting their own spiritual station and the unique work divine has given them. They're wishing they were someone else instead of excelling at being who they are right now.
So the goal for most people, the realistic goal, is to be this intermediate person.
Yes. The aspiration is to be an intermediate person, striving constantly not to be wicked even for a moment.
Meaning not giving in to sin in thought, speech, or action.
Correct. It's about winning the battle in the present moment. again and again. That's a practical, attainable goal, rather than just wishing you were perfectly righteous overnight.
And the specific task of this intermediate person is what exactly?
It's clear to subdue the inclination for evil and any thought that rises from the heart to the mind. This means, as we read earlier, completely avoiding his mind from it and repulsing it, as it were, with both hands, actively pushing it away. See, for the intermediate person, the evil inclination within the soul, it's still vigorous. It doesn't just disappear.
So they don't eradicate it. They just manage it, control its expression.
Exactly. Their control lies in preventing its expression in thought, speech, or action. And crucially, it lies in their rejection of the thoughts themselves, not necessarily in stopping them from popping up initially.
It's a constant active battle then, a spiritual wrestling match inside.
It absolutely is. A daily, hourly, moment-by-moment engagement with their inner world, not a state of effortless purity.
Okay, so this internal struggle is intense, personal. But you mentioned earlier it has wider implications. Does my own private mental battle, pushing away some random thought, really have any larger impact?
Yeah.
Beyond just me.
It absolutely does. And this is where it gets really cosmic and profound. There's a deep spiritual principle. With every repulsion of this thought from his mind, the spiritual force of opposition, the other side, is suppressed here below in this world.
So my interaction affects something out there. It weakens the forces opposing holiness.
Yes. Your internal choices have tangible effects on the spiritual landscape. And goes further. This connects to the idea of arousal from below. Our initiative, our effort here in suppressing that opposing force, it produces a corresponding arousal above.
Meaning our actions down here trigger a response in the higher spiritual realms.
Precisely. It's like sending a signal upwards. Our efforts ignite a reaction.
Wow. And what's the consequence of that up there?
The consequence is amazing. That spiritual force of opposition above in the supernal worlds, which is described poetically as soaring like an eagle, signifying its power and reach. It gets suppressed too. It gets brought down. It echoes that verse from Obadiah. Though you soar aloft like the eagle, I will yet bring you down from there, says divine.
So every time I push away an unwanted thought, I'm contributing to pulling down this cosmic eagle.
In essence, yes, you're participating in a universal act of subduing this pervasive spiritual force. It elevates your mundane internal struggle into a cosmic battle.
That turns a personal annoyance into something.
Yeah.
Heroic, almost.
It really does. Your small act of self-mastery contributes directly to a grand divine purpose, impacting the spiritual balance of everything.
That's incredible.
And ancient mystical texts talk about this extensively. They speak of the immense divine satisfaction, a deep spiritual contentment that happens when this opposing force is subdued down here. They describe it in the highest terms. It's not just a minor thing.
Oh, hi.
They emphasize the extraordinary nature of this pleasure, saying things like, thereby divine glory rises above all, more than by any other praise, and this ascent is greater than all else. Think about that. Your inner struggle, your quiet choice to banish a thought. It brings about a pleasure to the divine that surpasses all other forms of praise or devotion.
More than any other praise. That's staggering.
It highlights a unique and unparalleled elevation of divine glory. It's not just about our progress. It's fundamentally about the pleasure we bring to the Creator through this specific effort.
So just to be clear, my struggle isn't just okay. It's not just not a problem. It's actually an opportunity. An opportunity to bring about the greatest possible divine pleasure.
That is precisely the point. And yes, it's perhaps the most transformative insight here. It's the very entry of these thoughts into the mind of the intermediate person and their battle against them that enables fulfilling commands, subduing the opposition, and eliciting this unique, profound divine satisfaction.
Without the thought, there's no battle. And without the battle, this specific kind of divine pleasure doesn't happen.
Exactly. It redefines the purpose of those who struggle this way. Their struggle is their unique contribution.
Okay, following that logic, given this massive cosmic impact, could it be that this constant internal fight is someone's divinely ordained purpose? That maybe some people are kind of designed for this specific spiritual work?
That's a very perceptive question, and it leads straight to a truly radical idea in the text. It suggests perhaps this is what he was created for, and this is the service demanded of him, to subdue the spiritual force of opposition constantly. It proposes that for some, this lifelong internal grappling is their path, their primary contribution, their spiritual specialty.
Doesn't that bump up against free will? Like, are some people created wicked predestined to struggle. That sounds deterministic.
That's a crucial clarification, and the text addresses it. When an ancient source says, you have created wicked men, it absolutely does not mean they're created to actually be wicked in their actions or speech. That would negate free will.
Okay, so what does it mean?
It means they're created in such a way that that which occurs to the wicked specifically, these problematic thoughts and musings tend to enter their minds more readily. It's part of their spiritual makeup.
So it's a predisposition to the thought occurring, not a predetermination of their choice or action.
Exactly. Their inner landscape is just wired differently, making them more susceptible to these intrusions than, say, a perfectly righteous person.
So their unique mission, then, is the battle itself.
Yes. They shall eternally wage war to avert their minds from them in order to subjugate the spiritual force of opposition. And crucially, they might never completely annihilate that force within themselves. That complete transformation is the work of the perfectly righteous.
The role isn't eradication, but the ongoing fight.
Correct. The sustained effort, the constant grappling. Think of that cosmic wrestling match again. The intermediate person is always engaged. And the effort of that sustained struggle, the repeated choice to avert, that itself is the valued contribution.
Victory isn't silence, but the refusal to engage.
Precisely. And this leads to another fascinating idea. There are actually two kinds of divine pleasure. It's not a single type of satisfaction.
Two kinds.
The first kind comes from the complete annihilation of the opposing force, the transformation of bitter to sweet, darkness to light. This is achieved by the perfectly righteous. Their inner being is totally refined, purified. Their service is effortless holiness. That brings one kind of divine pleasure.
And the second kind?
The second kind arises when that opposing force is subdued while it's still strong and powerful, while it's soaring like that eagle. It's the act of toppling it from its height through human effort and struggle, especially when that struggle is real and challenging. That is the unique contribution of the intermediate person. They battle the enemy in its strength.
Both paths, the effortless holiness of the righteous and the constant struggle of the intermediate, bring unique and equally valuable forms of divine satisfaction. It's not like one is better, just different contributions.
Exactly that. Each category, the created righteous and the created to struggle, contributes one of these distinct forms of divine gratification. It's like a beautiful tapestry. Everyone's inner landscape and struggle has a valued place in bringing pleasure to the divine. Your specific makeup has its purpose.
That's really empowering.
There's a lovely analogy used based on an ancient text, and make me delicacies such as I love. Notice delicacies is plural.
Suggesting two kinds.
Yes. One kind of delicacy is like naturally sweet, luscious food. Think perfectly ripe fruit that represents the righteous. Their service is pure, inherent holiness. The second kind of delicacy, that's like sharp, sour, or even bitter ingredients that an expert chef transforms into an exquisite dish through skill and seasoning.
Like a complex sauce or a carefully prepared bitter green.
Exactly. That represents the intermediate person. They work with bitter stuff, battling the opposing force, the intrusive thoughts. Their intense effort in transforming these difficult inner experiences into something pleasing through their sustained work. That's like the chef's skill. The divine enjoys the transformation achieved through effort.
That makes sense. It also helps understand that verse from Proverbs, "Divine has made everything for his sake, even the wicked for the day of evil."
Right. It's not that people are made to be evil. It means the purpose of those susceptible to these inner evil thoughts is to transform that evil into day, into light above. They do this by subjugating the opposing force, uplifting divine glory in a way only they can, precisely because they started with that internal challenge.
Okay, this reframing of negative thoughts is powerful. But does this idea of battling the inclination and generating divine pleasure only apply to resisting outright sinful thoughts? Or does it extend into more subtle areas? Things that aren't wrong, but still require some self-control.
Excellent question. And yes, it absolutely extends beyond just resisting sin. The same divine pleasure comes from struggling with your nature, even when it comes to abstaining from permitted matters.
Permitted matters, like things that are totally okay to do.
Yes. Here's the principle. Any permissible action you do without a specific intention to serve the divine, like, say, eating just for pleasure, not for strength, for study and good deeds, that action actually draws its energy, its vitality, from what's called the other side, which just means the realm of the mundane, things lacking inherent holiness or higher intention.
So everyday actions done without spiritual focus are neutral, or drawing from this other side.
Basically, yes. Therefore, when you refrain from such an act, even a permitted one, specifically with the intention of subduing that natural impulse, that other side, you achieve the same profound result. You bring divine pleasure.
Even with something allowed.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Can you give examples?
Sure. Think about delaying a meal. You're really hungry, maybe after a long morning. Your body wants food now. But you consciously decide, okay, I'm going to push through and study for another hour, or even just 15 minutes before I eat.
Hmm.
Even if you were planning to study later anyway, or you do eventually eat, that specific act of sacrificing your immediate impulse to subdue that natural desire, that does it. The sages pointed this out, saying scholars often ate later than others, showing intentional restraint as a spiritual practice.
So delaying gratification, even for something permissible like food, when done with that intention.
No, yes, it becomes a spiritual act. Or take restraining speech.
Okay.
You're in a conversation, you have this strong urge to share some trivial news or gossip or just talk about mundane stuff because you want to talk. The words aren't sinful in themselves, but if you hold back precisely because you recognize that urge is just a desire for idle chatter and you choose silence or more meaningful conversation instead, that's the same principle.
You're subduing the impulse.
Exactly. The internal negotiation, overriding the immediate desire for a higher purpose, that's the work. Same with suppressing mundane thoughts. You're trying to focus, maybe pray or study, and your mind drifts to your shopping list or some worry about work. If you actively push that thought away, not because it's sinful, but because the desire to dwell on it is distracting you from your purpose, that's also subjugating the other side.
So even these tiny everyday acts of self-mastery, waiting to eat, not saying something trivial, redirecting a random thought, they all have this huge cosmic impact.
Absolutely. The texts confirm it. Even by the slightest subjugation of the other side here below, the glory of divine and his holiness is greatly elevated on high. It's not just about the big battles. It's the consistent, small choices to prioritize the spiritual over the merely natural or impulsive.
That puts a lot of weight on our daily choices.
It does. And there's a beautiful flip side to this, a reciprocal effect. When we elevate divine glory through our efforts below, from this holiness, a sublime holiness issues forth upon man below to assist him with a great and powerful aid in his service of divine.
So our effort actually draws down divine help for us.
Yes. It's a true partnership. Our initiative triggers a wave of divine assistance coming back to empower us further.
That's an amazing support system. Like, our small efforts unlock this huge divine boost.
Precisely. It echoes the sages again. If a person consecrates himself in a small measure here below, he is sanctified greatly from above. Your tiny step towards holiness is met with this massive outpouring from above, an exponential return.
Wow.
And there's one more layer. This act of self-sanctification in permitted things, it actually fulfills another positive divine command. Sanctify yourselves and be holy.
Okay, how does that work?
Well, that command is seen as primarily directed at intermediate persons. The righteous are already holy. For the intermediate, sanctify yourselves is an instruction. You make yourself holy.
It's an action we have to take.
Right. It means consciously separating yourself from the other side, drawing that line, asserting control. Even while that opposing force is still strong inside you, you're actively creating that separation.
And the second part, and be holy.
That's the promise. You will be holy. Ultimately, through this continuous process of self-sanctification below and receiving that great sanctification from above, you will eventually become truly holy. Divine aid helps you expel that inclination bit by bit until even the desires for those mundane things diminish. It's a journey towards real inner purity.
So it's not just about fighting thoughts, but actively transforming even okay actions into holy ones. And that process draws down help and leads to purification.
Exactly. It's a dynamic, ongoing path of spiritual elevation right in the midst of everyday life.
This has been incredibly insightful, a completely different way to look at our inner world. So just to recap the core message, the Alter Rebbe is telling us that getting sad about intrusive thoughts, especially during mundane life, is basically missing the point. Instead, these thoughts are actually unique opportunities for spiritual growth and, incredibly, for joy.
That's the heart of it. And we saw two main benefits, didn't we? First, by actively averting your attention, choosing not to engage, you fulfill a divine command right then and there. And that earns you a spiritual reward, turns a negative into a positive achievement.
Right. Benefit one. Fulfilling a command and getting rewarded.
Second, and maybe even more mind-blowing, is that this act pushes back against the spiritual force of opposition, not just inside you, but cosmically in the higher realms. And that subjugation brings this immense, unique pleasure to the divine and elevates divine glory like almost nothing else.
The benefit too. cosmic impact, and bringing unique divine satisfaction. Amazing.
And we learned this isn't just about resisting sin. Even small acts of self-mastery over permitted things, delaying gratification, controlling speech or thoughts with the right intention, they all contribute. They elevate the divine and in return, draw down powerful divine assistance for our own journey towards holiness.
It really validates the path of the intermediate person, doesn't it? Shows that their constant struggle isn't a flaw, but a profoundly meaningful and divinely cherished form of service. Different from the righteous, but equally valued.
Absolutely. It highlights that the internal battle itself holds immense purpose and brings about a unique kind of divine gratification. Your struggle matters profoundly.
So here's something for you, the listener, to think about. The next time an unwelcome thought or desire pops into your mind, instead of that usual sigh of frustration or despair, what if you saw it differently? What if you saw it as a tailor-made opportunity just for you, an opportunity to engage in a quiet battle that actually elevates the spiritual cosmos and brings profound satisfaction to the divine? How might seeing it that way change your whole relationship with your inner world?